The opinions and views expressed by the host and guest are not necessarily the views and opinions of the Blake Radio Network. Broadcasting to the world. Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul. BlakeRadio.com.
Good evening, this is Dr. Jennifer Daniels, and you are listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels. Today's topic is when the servant murders the master. That's a pretty interesting topic. However, there's been a little crisis here in the United States, a flu epidemic, I understand. So we're going to take the second half of the show, and we're going to talk about the flu epidemic. But the first part we're going to talk about is when the servant murders the master. The first thing is, who's the master? Well, the master is you. Absolutely is you. Each one of us into this world, master of our body, master of our lives. And what has happened as society has grown more and more complex is we have delegated many of our basic fundamental functions. We've delegated these functions, and in the course of delegating these functions, the servants we've delegated these functions to have perverted their assigned duties, into a system whereby it results in increased death in the masters, which would be individuals who were born really in charge of their bodies, in charge of their destiny, and things have gotten pretty out of hand. So we're going to talk about who these servants are, how they're murdering you, and how you can, either fire them, discipline them, or replace them. First, I'd like to let you know that you are listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels on the Rainbow Soul channel at BlakeRadio.com. And please visit VitalityCapsules.com and get your free gift, non-antibiotic solutions to 10 common infections. That is VitalityCapsules.com. And, of course, as always, I welcome your call and questions, so please call in at 914-338-0695. Okay, so what are some of the things that we have seen fit in our society, Western culture, to delegate? The first, and I think really most important function that's been delegated is food. Now, historically, the ability to delegate this function, to have someone else go out there and gather the food for you and to plant it, to harvest it, to prepare it and put it before you and serve it to you, has been associated with wealth. I mean, that's what kings do. And so this has been something that people have aspired to. Like, this is a great thing to be able to totally delegate this food function. Unfortunately, this hasn't worked out very well. Even the kings of old had to hire a taster to taste their food to make sure it wasn't poisoned. And so in modern days, what we've done is we've delegated our food function, but we don't have any taster at the door to taste our food so they can drop dead in case the food's no good. So what's with this food thing? Well, the way it turns out is people are born, end up here on Earth, and it's actually enough food in this Earth, I know it's tough to believe, but really enough food for everybody. And so the way things started out is people would hunt and they would gather their food. That's about the size of it. That was an okay deal, but people didn't live very long. You know, food supplies were pretty unreliable because you didn't know if there was going to be some food or not. So then we came up with this idea of farming, where people would save seeds, they would plant seeds, harvest the crops, and eat those. And that actually worked out pretty well. But what's happened in modern times is it's got to the point where the person planting the seed is totally unfamiliar with the person who's eating the plant. And so you have a total disconnect there. So this means that there's no link of family, no link of kinship that would, in the heart of the person planting the seed, make them think, you know what, I don't want to plant this poison seed because it might hurt my relative, you know, my spouse or my children or somebody I know. So because of that disconnect, it's just easier for people who plant seeds to plant dangerous or poisonous seeds. I'll give you an example. I had a patient in my medical practice, and he owned, I'd say, at least 10 acres of land. And he was an incredible farmer. He tended his plants, and everything that he raised was organic. And one year, I stopped by the farm to check it out. He said, oh, come see what I'm doing. I said, well, what's up? He says, I'm planting soybeans. I said, that's interesting. What is soybeans good for? I wasn't very sophisticated back then. I didn't realize there's all this stuff made from soy. So he told me all the lowdown on soy. I said, well, that's really interesting. How are you planting those? And he told me he's using this plant chemical and that chemical and the other chemical. And I said, oh, my gosh. Aren't those things poisonous? He said, well, yeah. I said, well, why are you putting poison in these plants? He says, well, the people who have already bought my crops want me to put poison on it, so I'm putting poison on it. Now, if he had known with certainty that he would be eating those crops and that his wife and his children would be eating those crops, he would probably be reluctant to follow the instructions and put poison on all these crops. And so because the food function has been delegated, we have this going on. We have this people not connecting that the poisons they're putting on this crop are actually harming somebody, or might even be harming somebody that they care about. So you have that going on. Then, of course, you have the primary issue of the seed itself, which is now, since we have technology, genetically modified. So this means that whether it's organic or not, in other words, whether it's planted with or without pesticides, the person eating it is going to have a difficult and unhealthy experience. So that's the growing part. But not only have we delegated the growth of our foods, we've actually delegated even the preparation of our food. This means like going to a restaurant, for example. So a restaurant will actually prepare a meal and serve it to some people that they call the public. Now, restaurants have an obligation. They have an obligation to serve food, but they need to serve it, you know, quickly enough so that during lunch hour, if you want to call it that, everyone who wants to eat lunch basically has the ability to eat lunch. This is their economic goals. This is how they profit. Unfortunately, this necessitates either holding food in a hot state overly long where the nutritional value is diminished, or putting chemicals in the food so the food will appear fresh and appear tasty. And again, this results in decreased vitality, decreased health, and premature death in people who choose to eat this food. And I can tell you, as a proponent of natural healing, you know, I've cured more than a few illnesses just by having people stop eating out, just by not eating out at the restaurant. And this is absolutely shocking. And it doesn't really much matter how expensive the restaurant is. It simply matters that the practices are at the restaurant. Unfortunately, most restaurants, just the nature of the beast and the process, that it produces a product that's not conducive to good health. not conducive to longevity. So the delegation of our planting our food, growing our food, preparing our food, serving our food, delegating all of this has created situations of premature death, basically. And so in a sense, we can easily say that these servants are poisoning you and me who have delegated this function to them. So the obvious solution, of course, is to, you know, take back this function. And it's easier, much easier said than done, I'll be really honest with you. When I was younger, in my 30s and 40s, I had three children at home and three jobs. Even though I was very, very busy, every day I would cook dinner. And the kids were really good. They were on their own for breakfast. And they were homeschooled, so we didn't have the breakfast, we didn't have the lunch issue. But that's a different story, you know, when you're young like that and you have all this energy, you can, you know, do 25 things at a time. Then as you get older, it's like, this is not really fun anymore. So what many cultures have done is solve this problem with intergenerational living. That means that the old folks and young folks live together, you know, the old folks help out with caring for the kids, and the people in the middle, you know, 20 to 40 or 20 to 50 go out and work, and, you know, you kind of divvy up the food preparation responsibilities. So somehow, though, the person cooking the food has to have an overriding economic, spiritual, and emotional interest in the good health of the people eating it. And in a restaurant, this is simply not the case. In a restaurant, simply the food has to taste good. It has to arrive in a condition acceptable to the patrons. And the long-term health benefits of the food are really not a huge selling point, because the reason you eat at a restaurant is because you want to eat today, not 20 years from now. So people eating at restaurants usually aren't focusing on health goals 20 years into the future. So the solution to the food problem is to take back a delegation to eat food at home, eat simple, simple food. Why simple food? Well, one, it's healthier, unprocessed. But second is, it's quick and easy to prepare. So you don't have to fuss with it. You don't have to do a lot of cooking and simmering and chopping. And personally, I've been known to just get a red pepper and just bite into it and eat it. So that's food, and that's huge, because food is just the absolute foundation of not only health, physical health, but even emotional health. If your food is prepared by somebody that you actually know and that you live with in your own home, you develop and strengthen this bond of incredible gratitude. And the person preparing the food also develops this incredible sense of obligation, of duty, of personal pride, and wanting to take the long view and enhance the health of everybody in the house. So food preparation, if it's delegated, should be delegated definitely to somebody who lives in the home where the food is being consumed and has an overriding interest in the good health of everyone who eats the food. The next function that's delegated, and this is really a shocker, and it's killing people, is housing. Say, oh my God, how can housing kill somebody? That's weird. Well, you know, often when they think of a house, they think of, well, you know, what could go wrong? Maybe the house could burn down, and occupants could, you know, perish in a fire. That's a possibility, and it does happen. But what happens more often is because of building codes and certain approved materials, materials in homes are actually toxic. And because the materials are, again, prepared a long distance away, in a factory, owned by somebody who's not living in the house that these materials are being placed into, they're filled with toxic chemicals to prevent deterioration, to prevent erosion. And these gases leave the sheetrock, leave the wood, leave the plastics, and actually poison the people who are living in the home. And this is a tragedy, because the first thing it causes is just extreme misery, whether it's brain fog or fibromyalgia. And this is something that's just almost impossible to overcome, except by moving. And again, because you have building codes, which are laws governing what materials can and cannot, should and should not be used in building a home, you know, you can't build a house out of biodegradable paper, for example. The materials and durability of things used are specified or pre-specified. So again, the solution to the housing situation, actually one solution that I'm familiar with, is simply getting an older home. This solves not only the toxic materials problem, because the materials have outgassed already over the first several years. So unless you have asbestos, you're pretty much okay. But the other thing is their insulation specifications in the north. And this means that basically the building code calls for what amounts to an airtight house. And this means that air does not circulate, and you can actually have poor indoor air quality, resulting in decreased length of life and quality of life. Really, it is a tremendous amount of suffering. The solution to this is to try to locate an area that does allow natural, non-toxic materials to be used in home construction and home building. That's one option, and the other option, as I mentioned before, is to get an older home where the house has already released all of its deadly materials, and that will be a healthier option. And finally, if it's possible, is to build your own home. In the old days, when they built a house one room at a time, and the people who lived in the house actually picked out and purchased the materials and built the house themselves. And so you get a situation where the materials being used were much less toxic. Now, they're not as durable. Of course, they need to be replaced over time. But I think it's a small price to pay. It's easier to replace housing materials than to replace one's body. The next area of delegation is energy. When you say energy, how does that play into things? Well, it turns out that how you get your energy is makes a big difference in terms of your health. The energy that's most harmonious with good health and with healing is wood burning, where you burn wood. The second healthiest is gas. And that would be like propane gas. And so what has happened with energy, since we've decentralized the whole energy issue, is that people are relying on gasoline, which when burned, creates air pollution. But even more, people are relying on electricity. And the problem with electricity is it often comes with an electromagnetic field. And these electromagnetic fields interfere with your body's own natural electric field and create things like headaches, fatigue, cancer, chronic pain. And so EMF pollution is becoming a huge issue now because now, the people we delegate our energy to, many of them, have decided to install smart meters in people's homes. And these smart meters radiate electromagnetic frequencies. People have even more and more electronic devices throughout their home. And many electronic devices, in order to turn on quickly when you have a switch, they have constant electricity running through them all the time. In other words, a very small electromagnetic field. And then now we have wireless technology, that would be the internet. And this wireless technology sends electromagnetic fields out that communicate back and forth with other, of course, wireless technology and wireless devices. So delegating energy consumption, allowing energy to be produced centrally and disseminated, have created a prevalence of electromagnetic fields, which have had devastating effects on people's health. So the solution is to, as much as possible, rely on wood-based energy. That would be burning wood for things like heating and cooking. And for other needs where electricity might be the only option, to minimize that, to have as few electronic devices as possible. And when sleeping, have them at least 3 feet away from the physical person. Of course, another EMF issue lately has been cell phones attached to the waistline. And, you know, it's a well-known fact that the sperm count of males is declining, and this is definitely not helping the matter, or not believed to be helping the matter. I'll let you know in a few years when my son is either able or not able to start a family. So EMS, energy, big, big deal. And simply delegating our energy needs has been a result of a lot of misery and a lack of health. And finally, transportation. Now, you wouldn't think about it, but transportation or delegating the transportation is huge. What has happened as a result of delegating transportation, of course, is we have the car. You say, how is that delegating transportation? Well, the primary mode of transportation is walking. So that would be the primary. So if a person accepts personal responsibility for their transportation, that would be walking. I know it's a novel concept. When I was a teenager, accepting responsibility for your transportation meant having your own car. But now that I'm older and a little bit wiser, I realize that, oops, our feet were meant to be primary mode of transportation. So what's the downside to delegating this transportation to cars? Well, some of the 35,000 deaths every year from car accidents is a consequence of delegating our transportation and not having society primarily based on walking. What else? Well, we have a whole cadre of illnesses simply based on sitting, like, for example, constipation. That's one illness caused in large part by sitting. And one place we'll do a lot of sitting is the car. Another consequence of delegating our transportation is air pollution, which causes respiratory illnesses like asthma, it worsens COPD, and causes bronchitis, and actually causes death. So we have the deaths from the car, we have the air pollution, we have the effect of a sedentary lifestyle on our health, and so it's really not been the great benefit that we perceive it as. Now, lately, because of technology, more and more people are actually able to work from home. So able to work from home and not have to get into the car. And that's huge. And I'm expecting with that revolution that there will actually be a decline in car accident deaths. So big thing in transportation is to, you know, not have that commute if you can avoid it. And the other thing is to try to use walking as a primary form of transportation or a greater form of transportation. Now, I live in a city, and I actually tried this. I was absolutely shocked to find the places I went to every day were easily a half-hour walk. Things that I thought were just right around the block were a half-hour walk away. It might have been like a five-hour car drive, little hike down there. I'm like, well, that's interesting. But when you're walking everywhere, first of all, it takes a long, long time. But second of all, you really start getting efficient about things. Like, okay, I guess it's time for me to definitely pool all of my errands. Let me find a place closer to home to get this done and that done. But it was really an actual exercise to realize that the community was designed to make walking as a form of transportation almost impossible. And that, unfortunately, is a design issue. But that's something that with consensus can be remedied. So transportation, we need to definitely take back that particular function and not delegate it. And one way to do that is to work from home, which now, again, with technology, is possible for more and more people, to live closer to where you work, or to do errands by walking. And by the way, half an hour of walking every day can cure diseases like hypertension and diabetes. So this delegation of transportation is not trivial. It's something that really has had an incredible impact on the health of individuals. And finally, the big delegation, the biggest one, the huge one, is healing. You know, people are born with immune systems capable of healing. In fact, it turns out that absolutely all healing is done by the immune system. As healers, you know, doctors and other healers can claim to assist the immune system, but you cannot have healing without the immune system. An excellent example of this is a corpse. You cannot bring a corpse back to life and reverse all that damage. The body has to be alive. It has to be capable of self-repair in order to heal. So simply the realization that the body is its own healing mechanism and has its internal tool chest will be a major breakthrough that would save, in the United States anyway, 767,000 lives. Because 767,000 people every year die just because they had access to health care. And so this delegation of healing is at the crux of the problem. Many people will get a crisis, like maybe intense pain from some medical condition. They'll go to the emergency room. Maybe it's a gallbladder, maybe it's a heart attack, whatever. And in the midst of their pain, in the intensity of their pain, they are offered a very expensive, very dangerous intervention, which at the time they say yes to, because, of course, if they don't say yes, then this will just, it'll kill them, because the pain is so severe that that's what their belief is. If, on the other hand, they believed that this pain is a severe crisis, yes, of course, and it will pass as their body resolves it, then what many people would find is that the pain would pass and they would not sustain the increased cost. Yes, it was scary. However, better to have pain that comes and then goes without having a surgical scar or a six-week recovery period. And so what has happened is, because we've delegated our healing to our servants, they have instead conspired to keep us ill, keep us sick, in fact, even make us sick for profit. And so delegation of the healing function is a very, very, very dangerous thing. The better thing to do is to make friends with somebody in your neighborhood who can be of help to you in such instances. Educate yourself on your body's healing abilities and natural healing. And even better, employ healing, natural healing, on your own behalf. So educate yourself and handle things at home. There's also a lot of bonuses. For example, if you have a health difficulty and you go to the hospital, it becomes a medical record, it raises your life insurance, your every kind of insurance, and it can even diminish your employment opportunities. So healing at home definitely makes a difference. And again, remember that medical care is beneficial. Certainly hospital care is beneficial to only about 2.25% of those who receive it. Mm-hmm. So the odds are not on your side. Definitely one to rethink in terms of your delegation. So that is That concludes the first half of the show, which is on the servant kills the master. This basically, what I've been talking about is how our delegation of common everyday functions such as food, housing, energy, and healing, and transportation have led to a state of illness, disease, and death. And reversing that delegation can make all the difference in the world. Station break here. You are listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels on the Rainbow Soul Channel, WakeRadio.com. Please visit VitalityCapsules.com and get your free gift, non-antibiotic solutions to 10 common infections. That is VitalityCapsules.com. Of course, I welcome your calls and questions. Please call in at 914-338-0695. Now, I got an email from one of my listeners, and they asked about the flu shot and the flu epidemic. And I said, flu epidemic? Well, we haven't had a good flu epidemic in the United States in my lifetime, and I'm 56 years old, well, 55. So what could this person possibly be talking about? I said, let me go check the Internet. There must be a story. Sure enough, there was a story. There was a flu epidemic in Boston just last week, and 18 people died. I said, 18 people, not a very big number. So let's take a look at the flu epidemic. Let's take a look at the flu shot. What's going on here? So what's the flu, and what seems to cause it, and how many people are dying of it? I think that's a good place to start because it's really important to kind of get a grip on how big the problem is. Like, how bad is it really? All right, so let's take a look here. First of all, what is the flu? Flu is an illness caused by a virus. It's a respiratory illness, but it affects the whole body. So you have to have a fever. If you don't have a fever, you don't have the flu. So flu is characterized by fever, chills, body aches, plus or minus a cough, usually a dry cough. So those are your basic hallmark symptoms of the flu. Now, things can go from bad to worse. Of course, you can have more symptoms than that, but those are the minimum. So if you have a fever, but you have no chills, no aches, and no cough, it's probably not the flu. Relax. So that's the flu. The what is it thing. Now, what causes the flu? Now, that's an important, that's an interesting concept. What causes the flu? We know a virus causes, but the question is this. How is it transmitted? Is the flu transmitted by person-to-person contact, like people coughing on other people? Get this. If the flu is really caused by person-to-person contact, then what you would notice is one person would get it, then another, then another, then another, and it would rise to a certain level, and then it would kind of taper off as people would get the flu, and it would keep going. People would get it and get better, and someone else would get it, and so on. So you wouldn't have a sharp rise and a sharp fall in the flu. It's not the curve of a person-to-person spread. You might have a big rise, like a steep rise, but you're going to have a kind of a blunting off, kind of a horizontal drift, maybe a horizontal drift down, but a horizontal drift. So that's what the curve should look like. So you should see a low incidence when that's not there. The virus somehow finds its way into the population. Maybe somebody, who knows what they did, didn't wash their hands, supposedly. Okay, I'll buy that. And then it rises slowly, 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 and then finally hits a critical point, and it takes a steep upward turn. And then, as it reaches a certain level in the population, it's going to the horizontal. Usually that level max is about 10%. And it has a blunt, but it's a blunt curve. That's important to know. It's a blunt curve. So let's take a look at the flu epidemic for the past 6 years. No, see, it's 2012, 2014, 2013. So 2013. So let's take a look at the last, maybe 23 years. So you can go online and find this at the CDC. They have these graphs. They're beautiful. But you see a curve that's horizontal. It spikes up very sharp, and then, boom, spikes down very sharp. Okay. That is a very troubling curve. That curve corresponds to basically poisoning, death. So in other words, if I put poison in a water supply, just something in the water supply, then what we expect is a big spike in sickness and illness. People all get sick concurrently, common source outbreak here. And then, since I wouldn't be putting any more poison in the water supply, just a one dose thing, then it would drop off. And that's exactly what the flu curves look like. So the epidemiology of the flu epidemics, I'm just talking about the past 14 years, you look at the graphs online, are not the epidemiology of person-to-person spread. Because person-to-person spread happens over time. And even if you have one person spreading it to 36 people, again, you still have a time factor. And so what we're looking at in those charts of deaths from flu is a pattern of common source outbreak. So if people are really interested, I don't know that anyone is, but really interested in reducing this illness characterized by fever, chills, aches, pains, and possibly death, then the way to go about it would be to find a common source outbreak. And it seems that this toxin or chemical or inciting activity is introduced anywhere between November and February. So that's really, really, that's an important piece of information to sort out there. When I went online with that, oh my God, that's not person-to-person spread. That's common source outbreak. All right, so maybe they're telling this person-to-person, but this thing they're measuring is a common source outbreak type pattern. All right, that's one thing. Let's take another look at this. Let's figure out, so how many people are dying from the flu every year? This is important to know. Now, if you look at the reports, the present reports indicate that anywhere from 36,000 to as many as 52,000 Americans in a given year can be expected to die from flu and pneumonia. Wait a minute. Pneumonia is not caused by a virus, it's caused by a bacteria. And pneumonia is not influenced or in any way mitigated or lessened by the flu shot. So when we're looking at flu, we can't add in pneumonia and flu deaths. So the 36,000 figure, 35,000 figure of death per year that you're seeing banded around in the media is referring to pneumonia plus flu. All right, so now we've got ourselves calm down, relax. We can say how much of that 38,000 or 35,000 deaths, actually it's a range between 35,000 and 52,000, how much of those deaths are actually due to the flu? And we can take this back, well, I think 23 years is good. Deaths have ranged anywhere from 227 deaths a year all the way up to a whopping 775 deaths a year in the whole United States. Yes, Rebob, the whole United States, only 775 deaths per year from the flu. The next question to ask is, well, who are these 775 people that are dying? Who are they and where are they? Well, they are people who are living in nursing homes, or they are people who have a very poor immune system, such as maybe people with cancer. In other words, people with normal immune systems are not dying from the flu. So if you have a normal immune system, then your chance of dying from the flu is pretty close to zero. That's if you don't do anything. Now, the other question to ask, okay, so we got that figured out. Now, by their own admission, the CDC does say that of these respiratory deaths, just 36,000, only 2 to 8% could be prevented by the flu shot. Why? Because only 2 to 8% of them are caused by the flu. And so depending on how many, what the numerator and denominator is, basically you're in that range of 225 to 775 deaths per year. So this is not a lot of deaths in a country of 311 million people. So with the flu shot, when you're looking at 775 deaths per year in a population of 311 million people, this is really a spit in the ocean. This doesn't even hold a candle to the 767,000 deaths per year due to medical attention, or, you know, medical care. All right, so we got to figure out how many people are dying every year from the flu. We know who's dying. People who are dying are people who are over 65 and people who are compromised with a bad immune system, example being cancer. So who is the shot being recommended for? Well, the shot is being recommended for everybody over the age of 18. But hold on. The people who are dying are over 65. So it's just a strategy, then. It doesn't make sense. If you're under 65, you take the shot because there's not a death rate in that, you know, in that age group from the flu. That's number one. And number two, as we talked about before, the pattern of the flu infection is a common source outbreak pattern. It's like someone's just dumping this virus, if you want to say that, or another chemical that's being blamed for the virus as being just a scapegoat, possibly. And so the person-to-person spread theory doesn't work because of the, again, the epidemiology and the shape of the graph. And I got to tell you, this is my personal opinion. Reasonable minds may differ, and you know the experts. They might have a different opinion, and that's okay, too. So the next issue is, what about the vaccine? What about the vaccine? So let's say you decide to get the flu vaccine. What can you expect? Well, if you get the flu vaccine, you can expect that you're going to produce antibodies in approximately 2 weeks. If you produce antibodies in 2 weeks, how long will that protection last? You know, the CDC is very vague about that. You would think that they could tell you it's going to last 2 weeks, 10 weeks, 20 weeks, whatever. All I know is you have to get a new shot every year. So you can wait, expect that they'll take 2 weeks to take effect. Well, but will it really take effect? That's a good question, because the flu shot is a conglomeration of antigens that defend against three different viruses that they anticipate the flu is going to mutate to. And so it could mutate to any of thousands of viruses, and they only have three per shot. Well, if they guess the wrong three, and I'm going to tell you, honestly, I've been in medical practice from 1990 to 2000. That's when I had a medical practice. And they did not guess the virus strain correct, not one of those years. And so they had a big push. Everyone get vaccinated in November, and which many people did. And then what they would say is, oh, my God, we guessed wrong. It's the wrong flu strain. You have to get vaccinated again. Wait a minute. If the vaccine was ineffective because they put the wrong stuff in it, how is getting the vaccine twice going to be more helpful? I mean, two times nothing is still nothing. So that's the rationale. That's the rationale that's presently being used. So if you get the flu shot, it'll take 2 weeks to take effective. Because of the method of selecting the antibody or the antigen, there may not be an antigen-antibody match, that's Greek for the vaccine might not be helpful. And so you can't predict if it's going to be useful at all. And so what's going to happen? You can expect a sore, achy, painful arm, plus or minus a fever. Sounds a lot like the flu, doesn't it? Fever, pain, yep, adding up. Now, let's just say the flu really is out there and really could kill somebody. There are things you can do to increase your chances of dying from the flu. Would you like to know what they are just so you could avoid them? I thought you would. There's something called H2 blockers and proton pump inhibitors. What are these? These are pills you take for indigestion that reduce the acid in your stomach. It's the acid in your stomach that kills viruses and kills these infections and helps you live longer. So if you're taking an H2 blocker and you really don't want to get the flu, more or less, you don't want to die of it, then I would say those are, it's definitely time to stop taking those drugs. And so the other question you might want to ask is the vaccine safe? This is difficult information to get at. There's a lot of information on both sides. You have to ask yourself, what does safe mean? So rather than debate that whole thing, I will share with you my 20 years of medical practice from, actually, it's, wow, 1979 is when I first started keeping track of this, all the way up to 2000. So that's from 21 years. So in 21 years of medical practice, and I'm counting all my time in medical school and residency, working on Indian reservations and in private practice, everything, whole ball of wax, I saw not one death from the flu, not one. All right? Okay, put that, hold that there in your brain. Another piece of information. I saw two cases of Guillain-Barré. What's Guillain-Barré? Guillain-Barré is basically total body paralysis as a complication of the flu shot. Yeah. So this is just one person's observation after being exposed to, you know, tens of thousands of patients. You can decide for yourself if that's a reasonable sample size. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But I saw two people totally devastated by the flu shot and not one person dead from the vaccine, from the flu itself. So that is something worth thinking about in terms of whether or not you want to get the flu shot. Now, you guys also might have a very personal question to ask me. A personal question would be, well, Dr. Daniels, did you get the flu shot? And the answer is, no, I don't get the flu shot. I used to get the flu shot. Because in medical school, we have, of course, good things. So you've got to get the flu shot. You've got to get the flu shot. And I said, well, okay, fine. I'll get the flu shot. But I was in between pregnancies. So I had just had my first child, actually my second child, and I was trying to get pregnant with my third child. And I thought, I might be pregnant. Well, it was in November. And so I did not get the flu shot. And, of course, since I didn't get the flu shot in November, way back then, that meant I missed the season for flu shot. I felt so healthy, I'm telling you, I never got it again. And that was back in the year of 1991. So after that, I never got another flu shot. Now, I haven't also had my private practice at the time, so being a good doctor, I thought, all of my employees should get the flu shot. So, of course, I gave Mom the flu shot. Ugh, mistake. Mom's arm got so painful, and she couldn't work at the front desk for 2 weeks. I'm like, oh, boy. Oh, no, no, no. We cannot have this kind of absenteeism. So, no, I don't get the flu shot. Of course, Mom, even though she's a good mother, refused to get any more flu shots. And so I took the policy in my practice of saying to patients, look, this is the deal. If you want the flu shot, I'll give it to you. If you don't, you don't. I don't think anyone should be in any way compelled to take the flu shot. And there seems to be no evidence either way that it's effective. And we have some callers here, so I'd like to just say hello. Caller 4747, let me click this. No, I'm clicking the wrong box here. Hi, caller, you're on the air. Who am I talking to?
I'm just listening.
Oh, okay. All right, just wanted to check in and say hello.
Yeah, I just tuned in myself, so I'm just listening. And if you say something where I need to ask a question, I will, though.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so, the flu shot, then, the question is, should you get it, shouldn't you get it? The answer is, it's a personal decision, every bit as private as, you know, what movie you want to go to this weekend. It is totally, totally your decision. And you should in no way feel that you are endangering either your life or anyone else's life by not getting the flu shot. So that's key. You need to realize that this is totally a private decision, it just so happens the government is subsidizing this private decision, but that's okay too. But you should realize that. So what do you do if you really want to protect yourself against this probability of being one of the unlucky 775 people this year who might die of the flu? First of all, do not live in a nursing home. Don't do it. And if you're in a nursing home, whether you get the flu shot or whether you don't, you're pretty much, you're at very high risk of being one of the unlucky 775. So that's one. Don't be in a nursing home. Next, just don't be over 65. So, but you don't have control over that. So if you're not over 65, either you are or you aren't. If you're over 65, you're at a higher risk of getting the flu. But then you're also at higher risk of getting a complication from the flu shot itself. So that is another consideration. The other issue is, okay, so you want to protect yourself against the flu. Maybe you're like me. Maybe you're a chicken. You don't want to take the flu shot. But let's say you don't want to take the flu shot. This is a virus, and you want to protect yourself. There are some very powerful antiviral agents out there. No, I'm not talking about Famvir. You can take vitamin C. Yes, you can take vitamin C. And the way you take vitamin C is you take one teaspoon of powdered vitamin C. You could take capsules, but it's very inefficient because you have to take so many of them. You take one teaspoon of vitamin C, stir it up in some water. I recommend a pint of water, and you drink it. And you increase it bit by bit by bit to as much vitamin C powder as you need to develop 3 bowel movements a day. A couple of things this does. One, the vitamin C is directly antiviral. It actually kills viruses. Two, the vitamin C empties your intestines. So whenever you have a viral infection, the only way the viral infection can take hold is because your bowels are holding waste in. And when the immune system tries to get rid of the infection, it brings all the viruses right to your intestines. If your intestines aren't moving freely and frequently, then those viruses accumulate, multiply, have babies, and eventually can overcome your body. So the vitamin C works that way as well. And third, the vitamin C directly boosts the immune system and your body's ATP energy transfer system. So vitamin C is very good, a very good benefit. That would be my favorite. The next option is garlic. Now, if you've used garlic, you know garlic is pretty smelly stuff. So that is something that's a negative about garlic. So garlic is very smelly, number one. Next thing about garlic is garlic thins the body tremendously. And it thins the blood tremendously, so it can interact with other blood-thinning medications. My posture on that is cut back or stop the other blood-thinning medicines. Check with your doctor. Say, hey, I'm going to take some garlic. You adjust my medicines and lower it so I'm not going to get any side effects. Vitamin C is the same thing. Vitamin C does thin the blood as well, but it doesn't seem to be as powerful as garlic does. I'm going to pause for a minute here and take this question. Let me see if I can do this. Hi, 6367, you on the air?
Yeah, this is John Delia. I have a question for you, Dr. Daniels. I was reading about lipospheric vitamin C, and I was wondering what you think about that as far as the usability by the body. Is it hype, or is it really much better way to for the body to absorb it?
Okay, lipospheric vitamin C. Vitamin C is water soluble. And so what they're doing then is they're adhering it to a fat sphere. And so the thinking about this is that this fat will go into the intestines and boom, hit the wall of the intestines, which will then open up. It's just the way it's built. And then the vitamin C can go in, boom, right into the blood. That is not necessarily an advantage. And the reason it's not an advantage is because vitamin C kills the viruses right there in the intestines where they are doing their harm. So it kills them right there in the intestines. It opens up the intestines and flushes them right out of the body. And so what this formulation is doing is it's instead of allowing the vitamin C to stay in the intestines a little longer, and do really the bulk of its work, it's putting the vitamin C right into the blood, which is like, which is backwards. I mean, that's like you trying to empty the trash, and last week's trash is still sitting at the curb. Well, you're just not going to get very far. So I would not suggest something like that. I would suggest ascorbic acid or just plain water-soluble vitamin C, and let it work the way nature intended, which is to first clear out the intestines, kill all the viruses in the intestines, and allow the rest of the immune system, which is already hard at work, to bring all the viruses to the intestine, the intestines now being empty and ready to receive them. So that would be the answer to that. And there's always, you know, if that's where the money's made, is when you say, you know what, I've got a better idea. I can do better than nature. I've got an answer. Nature made a mistake, and I'm going to fix it. And so that particular attitude, you know, it's a tempting attitude, but even better, it's a profitable one. So I would say that's really what's going on there at that particular point. So vitamin C is my antimicrobial choice, although garlic is a close second. The reason I don't like garlic is garlic, although it does kill viruses, does not cause the intestines to empty, and garlic can cause discomfort throughout the body as it does war with the viruses at every level. Whereas vitamin C is much more diplomatic. It just says, okay, the door's that way. The next thing is you have to drink water. You've got to hydrate yourself. And this is a real issue, especially in the North, because in the North, it's cold. What that means is you're wearing a lot of clothes. Every time you use the potty, what you have to do, you've got to take all these clothes off. I'm telling you, it's worth it. So you have to drink water. Yes, you're going to urinate more frequently, but that's another way that your body gets rid of viruses is literally you piss them out. So you've got to drink water, and you've got to take some antimicrobial every day. And I'm going to tell you, you probably just feel so much better in general. So those are two things that are worth doing. The other thing that's worth doing is taking a look at what you're eating. If you can just cut back on the probably the milk and the bread, milk, bread, and sugar would be the biggies. Just ease up on those things, you'll do fine. So if someone brings cookies to work, that's fine. You know, take a cookie, don't eat it, pass it off to somebody else, and say thank you very much. People won't even notice. So you really have to be a little more attentive about your diet during this flu season, if you want to call it that. But again, 775 deaths, I'm almost embarrassed to talk about it because it's such a small number. Now we have another caller in line. I'm just going to say hello here. Hi, 6989, you're on the air. Okay. Whoops. Let me tell you. So that's really it for the flu. The important thing about the flu is to remain calm and then really enjoy your life, because if you're walking, talking, and breathing, chances are outstanding that this flu is going to pass you right by. So I'd like to remind people to stop by vitalitycapsules.com and sign up for their free gift, which is non-antibiotic solutions to 10 common illnesses. And as we now understand, antibiotics are literally the foundation of illness. All right, well, that's it for this week's episode. We'll see you back again next week for Healing with Dr. Daniels at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here. Thank you very much, and we'll talk to you soon. Oh,